Welcome to the Social Exchange Podcast. I'm Zach Rhodes, and this is episode number 75. It's been a while since creating episodes, and I do apologize for the delay. I was finishing up my work in a school system and had a few loose ends to tie together before enjoying a more relaxing summer, rich with podcast interviews on this channel, so you can expect a high volume of podcasts coming out this summer, as well as exclusive Patreon content, which you can access at patreon.com/thesocialexchange. Today's guest is Desha Milla. Desh is the founder of This Is 42, which is a platform for highly regarded educators and content creators like Coleman Hughes, Michael Shermer, Sam Harris, Neil deGrasse Tyson, and more. He's also the producer of the films Islam and the Future of Tolerance, which starred Sam Harris and Majid Nawaz, and more recently, the documentary film Better Left Unsaid, which you can find in the show notes. Today we talked about Desh's life journey, living through civil war in Sri Lanka, moving to Australia, not knowing more than a few key phrases in English, and eventually graduating from Melbourne's Deakin University and becoming an entrepreneur, filmmaker, and an educator on a global scale. We then discuss his newest film with Kurt Jermungal, Better Left Unsaid, which illuminates key issues regarding radical politics both on the left and the right, in the US and around the world. This episode does have a quirk. Our final 2 minutes got cut off by virtue of technology, or more precisely, from the user of technology. Please forgive me and forgive the abrupt ending. I did reach back out to Desh to let him know that this happened, and he's comfortable that he got across his main points. Just make sure that you follow the links in the show notes to learn more. Now, please enjoy this interview, which is episode number 75 with Desh Milla. Desh, thank you so much for being with me.
Pleasure to be here.
So I don't know if I'll leave in what we were just talking about. Maybe I should for a nice touch, but you're one of the great minds behind the new documentary, about social and political extremism, if I can say that, which can stem from both left and right. The focus was largely on the left, and maybe we'll get to in a second why that was, but this is an issue I think that's on everybody's mind, but you know, no matter where they stand on the issue, I think it's in the zeitgeist, let's say, but it can be really complicated and tricky to tackle. And I think that the film did a good job of putting things succinctly, but not putting them too simply. And it handles the subject matter well, makes strong points, so that an idiot like me could digest and understand it. So I would like to discuss the film, but I'd love to know more about you first, Desh, because I learned as I was looking more into your work, I know that you were born in Sri Lanka, and you lived there during periods of civil war, and eventually moved to Australia. And this, I would imagine that since you've been interviewed a lot, this is like you tell the story over and over again. But if you could give me the potted, what was life like in Sri Lanka, and why the move?
I don't get tired of telling this story because I realize it's an unusual story for a lot of people in the West, because in the West, the stories of war are stories told from the past. Very few people actually come out and tell a story of lived experience. And that sort of put things in perspective in some scenarios. So when I was living in Sri Lanka, so I was born in 1981, that's the year the civil war broke out in Sri Lanka, which lasted 28 years. Hundreds of thousands of people died. And this was, it didn't come out of thin air. There's a long history. It really started, it's funny to say this, you know, when the British eventually left, just like every other place they've colonized, they left some misguided understanding of leaving things intact eventually is what led to a civil war. It took many years. So when you're born there and living there, you don't think there's anything wrong with it. So as a child and as a teenager, I genuinely believed I was living in the best place on planet Earth to live. I scoffed at the West and other places because it was generally quite normal to hear on national television, which was the state broadcaster. Now, I say state broadcaster is, if you watch, if you listen to NPR and watch PBS. It's very different to a state broadcaster under a civil war, because it is primarily just propaganda. Mm. And because of that, and that is the only station that reaches the furthest corners of the country, so everyone gets information through that. So you are living in an alternative reality to what is actually happening, and you have no idea about anything else. And this is pre-social media. So for me as a child, regardless of the carnage that was happening around me, it was the best place to live. Sri Lanka is a beautiful place. And I lived in the hill country. So, you know, as a kid, it was fantastic. In many sense, it was but I did have this strange feeling as a child that I didn't really belong. I'm personally not with my family. I moved around a lot. I was in boarding schools when I was year six. I got a scholarship I was 6 years old when I went to boarding school. And then in year five, I got a scholarship and I went to Colombo, which is a big city. And again, I lived on my own till I was in year 12. And then I still felt like, you know, Sri Lanka's not the place for me. I just had these ideas and things I wanted to do that at that point didn't exist in Sri Lanka. So I wanted to get out of Sri Lanka so I could do those things. And I tried hard to get to India because India had, and still does, the world's largest film industry. I was always a creative in mind, so I wanted to get in there. Now in retrospect, luckily, that plan didn't work out. I say luckily because Bollywood is a very, very competitive space and it's not that simple to get in. So then I just tried to apply for Australian universities with no absolute hope of ever getting there, because you know, my family, a poor family from a small town in Sri Lanka, they didn't have the money. But I just got extremely lucky. I really, really got lucky that I had the opportunity to come to Australia in the form of getting the initial visa as an international student. That wasn't that simple. But, you know, the long story short is my family and relatives got together, pooled some money, paid for a one-way ticket, gave me a small bit of money and told me good luck. You know, this is what you want to do. So, all right, they had no idea what is it that I wanted to do. And I don't think I really had an idea. I just wanted to get out because I just wanted to do these things. It wasn't because of the war, funnily enough, that I left. It was just the education I was chasing. So that's how I came to Australia. It was the first time getting on a plane, first time going into a Western country. And it has been a journey so far.
That sounds terrifying. A one-way ticket out of the place that you know and love, I suppose. But
I mean, it was grounded in a hope and a dream that there were better opportunities on the other side. Mm. And it was one part utterly terrifying because I didn't know anyone. I didn't have any relatives in Australia, and my grasp of the English language was poor. I couldn't really speak. I could understand. So I could have a conversation and get by saying yes, no, and a few things. And I haven't actually shared this story. So there was an interview to grant my visa, and I did a lot of research through other people who've gone to that interview, and I knew what the questions they were going to ask. So I rehearsed the answers. I didn't know if I gave the right answers to the right questions. I just repeated what I rehearsed.
Wow.
And I assume I nailed it, but I don't know what they asked me.
Wow. Oh, if I were a good like improv comic, I would think of something right now that mismatched the question and the answer. That's so interesting.
I think it, even if I mismatch it, it may have come across as I've really put some thought into it and it's sort of a different way of answering. Yeah, it's just, it's, you know what I mean? Like they would have imbued some meaning to what I just said because I said
so
it because, you know, and I was a drama student. I was, you know, really into sort of radio. And so I could present myself as like, I really know what I'm talking about. But I can assure you, other than "Hi, how are you?" when she first asked me, the lady who interviewed me had no idea what she asked me throughout the whole interview.
Well, that's what you say is so true. Like I work with a lot of journalists, and they could say any odd bullshit at any time, and I just assume that they know what they're talking about. I don't, but so what got you start? If you didn't leave because of the war, and you wanted to do something bigger, better, brighter. What got you to start, and I might be just skipping a step here, but the organizations, I think the first one was Think Inc., is that what it's called? And now this is 42. This seemed like
that's correct.
Very much a niche about, civics and education, social issues. Is that something you knew you wanted to do, or did that just blossom sort of organically?
Well, look, when I left Sri Lanka, I didn't necessarily have quite a specific idea what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to eventually get into filmmaking, but I didn't get to that point for 17 years since I left. Islam and the Future of Tolerance only came to be in 2017. Before that, I was dabbling in some creative products, but wasn't really filmmaking. Now, how did that transpire into sort of the civic and social engagement stuff? That happened organically. And now, with Better Left Unsaid, I had a deliberate thought process. But before that, it was just an organic process. What I got into was, I whatever opportunity that came my way, within reason that I could manage to do, I took it on. Being the financial situation I was in, I was forced to have multiple jobs while having a full-time university. My visa was predicated on me getting a certain set of grades, appearing at university, so it was incredibly challenging. So I couldn't take on all the opportunities that came my way, but most of them I took on. So it started off me getting into community radio, which led me into the event sector in Australia, which eventually led me into being a little, just the entertainment industry I was in. And I became a DJ, and I was touring, and I was organizing events. I was, everything from club nights to after parties to then big events with American hip hop artists. It was fun at first, young, I've never been exposed to any of this stuff. It was great fun, but very soon I got to the point, it's the same over and over again, and it wasn't really giving anything for me. Yeah. And that's, I was personally going through a journey of trying to understand basically my place in this universe. It started off of me trying to get into religion. I had a 2-year journey where, I was born in Sri Lanka. So 75% of Sri Lanka is Buddhist. So I was born into a Buddhist family. So I had a fair bit of knowledge about Buddhism, but that's all I did. So at this point in my life in Australia, I went through a journey where I joined a born again Christian movement. And I have this thing, once I get into something, I go all in. So I went all in. I was being trained to be youth minister within months. I got obviously baptized, and I went all in. And then, but this part of my brain was like, this doesn't make much sense what you're doing right now. And that space, and that led me to, read the Quran and some hadiths. And I was like, okay, there's something here, but this still doesn't make much sense. I read the Mormon Bible, and I went through this massive journey, and then eventually led me to, old philosophy books and new philosophy books. And that spat me out as an atheist at the end of all of this. And that then gave me a bit more understanding of the world around me and this new curiosity about science and sort of philosophy. This was happening at the same time I was getting over this, music world. And that led me to create Think Inc. because I wanted to figure out a way how to get people like me and young people at that point who are interested in sort of entertainment stuff, but also have some curiosity towards science and reason. So that's what led me to create Think Inc. My whole idea was, and to a certain degree is make being intelligent cool, right? So that's why I created Think Inc. And with that, I had this incredible journey for a number of years, since 2010 till 2018. Eventually, I sold the company. And with This Is 42, I was trying to expand on that. For the first 2 years with This Is 42, I was trying to do too many things. I now have a more solid ground of what This Is 42 is trying to do or is doing. This Is 42 now is primarily a media production company and a consultancy firm. So we basically provide the backbone for a number of intellectuals to be in front of larger audiences. That is in the form of podcast production, for event management, talent management, and also we work with organizations who are trying to do this, because I have this decade of knowledge of taking this intellectuals into this massive amount of people, number of people rather, that sort of gave me, there's a bit of a science to it. So let me pass on that information to as many people as possible. So that's what This Is 42 is doing. And on the side of that, it's now given me the tools I need to make the films I wanted to make. So we produce films on top of producing podcasts. So you, I hope that answered your question. Wait, actually, no, your question is, why this, this sort of social subject matter, et cetera. The reason being is now I have a lot more, I think it came with age, that I realize there are so many social issues that people are tackling, whether it's climate change, political issues, etc. But I notice when there is an important subject matter, in 2017, it was Islam's place in the world, nobody wanted to talk about it. It was this thing that everyone was scared about to talk about. And I was like, there is a way to talk about this. And I found these two intellectuals who was having this amazing conversation. And I turned that into a film. Mm. Yeah, that's the origins of Islam and the Future of Tolerance. And now in today's world, the geopolitics of the West, which has a direct influence into the rest of the world, because America exports its democracy to the rest of the world, just like it's music and entertainment. So I can see what's happening. And part of that terrifies me. So I've been wanting to make a film addressing that. And so now my interest, last few years, have really been sort of poking at issues that people think that we shouldn't be talking about. I did an event that became a huge controversy about feminism, because I found the current wave of feminism rather confusing. And then I organized a third or fourth wave feminist, I don't know what wave it is anymore, Roxane Gay, to have a conversation with more of a second wave feminist, Christina of Summers. That was rather a failed conversation, because didn't necessarily see eye to eye, one party mainly. But that's kind of my interest. And Better Left Unsaid is taking on that tradition for me, is talking about extremism in modern politics in the West. And we can talk about more why I spent a fair bit of time on one section than the other. But I hope I answered your question there.
You answered it very well. Before we do that, I'm curious. This is always something I'm curious about, people's struggles in the beginning before they create something worthwhile and productive. You said you were trying to take on too many things at once at the beginning of This Is 42. What are some of those too many things?
Well, I wanted to still continue to run events in Australia, although I already had the knowledge that scalability from a business perspective already hit a limit. When I first started doing what I did, nobody was doing that. Actually, and you can look it up, and if your listeners can look it up, I couldn't find, before 2010, an intellectual touring company, a touring company that was specifically just touring intellectual. It wasn't a thing that existed. There were companies that were touring just comedians, you know, like TV personalities, but no one thought of just intellectuals. And that's what I created. Now, five years later, people started seeing, ooh, we can do that. And there were competitors, but I had a really good run. But I got to the like market cap of Australia and New Zealand. And for some reason, when I started This Is 42, I'm like, I'm going to do that as well. And I want to make films. I want to produce podcasts. And I want to create these short YouTube videos explaining things. And I want to manage talent. And I want to, what else did I want to do? There were so many things. I completely confused my entire team because what to focus at a given time, because I felt like I have this freedom now to start again. And what would I do this time around? So all of those moving parts.
Do you feel like all that too muchness was necessary to create what you, in some ways, I mean, of course it is, but yeah, sorry.
Yeah, so in a way, now one would look at my organizational structure and say, you're doing too much now. But starting with sort of lack of organized chaos, it was just chaos. You know, now I have organized chaos within the organization. But there's at least an overarching understanding why, what are these moving parts and where they're all going. They all have a similar thing. And to, that's how my brain works. So this comes with time. When I did my first thinking event 2010, I couldn't see how it could go wrong. It didn't go wrong as far as a public concern, but behind the scenes financially, it did. And it took me a number of years to work out how to bring everything back and then start again. And I've learned from my mistakes. So this time around, when I realized it's not working, I was quick enough to pivot the business way. And it was kind of funny. When I did what I did, it was like a month before the pandemic hit. So I decided to stop running events a month before the industry completely shut down itself.
Wow.
You know, I was like, well, that was good timing.
You brought it in for a landing before it got chaotic. Wow.
Right.
Okay. So you do not strike me as a person who talks about things that are, let's say, controversial for the sake of being controversial. It seems important to you that you get to the bottom of issues or you know, at least give it your best try, especially if you're the kind of person who can dip your toe into sort of an ideological framework so many different times. Think about it, pull yourself out of it, know that you want a sort of a community or ideas to contextualize yourself in, but you're willing to try on different, you know, different ideas. So why was it important to you to talk about extremism in the West?
Well, you're right. I'm not interested in being a provocateur. I don't want to poke a hornet's nest just because it's fun to do or to get some attention to me. I am very comfortable staying behind the scenes and letting the smarter minds to talk things, just giving them the platform. I only tend to get in front of a camera if I need to do it. Now, why is it important? In the context of better left unsaid, in the last few years, I mean, really, the Trump presidency brought out the most chaotic political scenario I've seen in the whole world. And it's not Trump's fault. Is merely a manifestation of symptoms and the illness that existed within the system for years. Your Trumps, your Boris Johnsons, your Bolsonaros, to Duterte's in Sri Lanka, Gotabia, all of those leaders have, oh, Modi in India, they all have a relatively common theme. You know, they're very strong personalities and they like to have a lot of control and they tend to do things that, you know, a democracy should not be doing. And they They feel as they are a form of saviors that is going to save a nation or its people. And for me, the vivid memory of a civil war and how the country was governed at that point, and having a good understanding of what led to a civil war, it's now, as an adult, I look back at it, and it's constantly in my mind. And in the last 4 or 5 years, when people started throwing things like civil war, like, you know, when Americans talk about civil war and really enthusiastically, like they want it, I was like, you know, it's this romanticized idea of civil war, revolution. If you speak to people who've been through that journey, you'd realize they do not want that at all. And then I started hearing some terrible ideas presented as really good ideas, not only by people on a radical fringe, but mainstream. And somehow, like, it's artists and actors and big TV personalities were throwing ideas around. And I was like, I can't be the only one. This shouldn't be how you're looking at this particular issue.
Like, what's an example of something that caught your attention?
Well, you know, the idea of Marxist ideology presented as, no, I haven't made this very clear, and I want to make it very clear. I am on the political left in most cases. Right. Recently, I've come to the and I'm a liberal, small L liberal in every political policy. So I consider myself to be on the political left. But I realize more and more I have been pushed to the center because the current political left is quite different to what it was a few years ago. So when I started hearing multi-millionaires talking about burning, looting is an absolute necessity to get a message across.
Yeah.
And in encouraging that behavior, and even using language like kill the rich, eat the rich, like, you know, they are using it with some satirical underpinning, but not really understanding where is these thoughts coming from. And then this terminology like deconstructing, revolution, anarchism is just used very lackadaisically, as it's like, this is what we need to do. We need to bring the system down. And these were presented as somehow really good ideas that we haven't tried before. And that's freaked me out, in the sense, like, what people aren't realizing, and this is the paradox of reason/science-led societies. When things get so good, people are looking for a reason to, you know, you need a black and white narrative to, you know, Hollywood's an amazing job of presenting you with the absolute evil, like Darth Vader looking person. Mm-hmm. So you need that, you need to be good, you need to have this good fighting evil. It's this consistent battle. And these ideas were presented in that light, that this is a societal necessary, that we need to fight this evil. Now, this is not exclusive to one side of the political aisle. Various forms of is this presented by both the political left and the right. But there were some people that I respected were throwing some ideas that I knew were to be terrible ideas. And this I'd recognized a few years ago. And that's what sort of led me to start looking into this, eventually making the movie.
You know, I was thinking about this. I hear the term Orwellian thrown around all the time. And I've read and taught about Orwell for a few years now. And it's funny, each political side talks about the other side being Orwellian. Well, the speech is Orwellian. And so then you get the, we have to combat this. Both sides have this idea, let's say, especially the left, has the idea of, well, let's burn it all to the ground, you know, without doing the courtesy act of trying to fix things first. But both sides feel that as though their rhetoric is okay, even though it might sound sort of Orwellian, because we sort of are smarter than, or, you know, more wise than any of these things that have happened in history. For the left, I find that interesting because I think that the only reason you could be confident that you could be speaking this way and things won't go horribly for you would have to be because the institutions would be strong enough to withhold you when you're acting so destructively. I'm curious to get your thoughts on that. It's something that's been percolating, but I haven't really talked much about.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is one of the things why, when I mentioned that it got me worried and somewhat irked when people talk about warning civil war or, you know, warning revolution, not really understanding what is it that they're asking for. There's this notion, and there's plenty of data now that's come out. You know, the group of people who advocated more strongly for the literal defunding of the police,
mm-hmm.
not figurative, but literal. They are speaking on behalf of a community that they have relatively limited understanding. If you look at most of those places, if you ask the people who live there, they overwhelmingly want more police, right? So the reason I use that example to try and elaborate the point that you made is, the reason that they have the ability to even go out and say, the people who make the claims on the far, furthest of the left, defund this, and, you know, they can burn things down and not get into serious trouble, is what they don't realize is because the systems are working, you have a level of ability to be free.
Right.
I've had this conversation with a career activist who's been doing it for like 20 years, who wants to bring down the system, but who's been on Social Security for his entire adult life, basically using the, and this is not to, you know, I know some people use this term, you know, right-wing talking points and whatnot. This is an anecdotal piece of evidence I'm trying to say is, you know, the reason that this particular activist has the opportunity to be free and to be the anarchist and doing all the things and never really getting into any serious trouble is he has the free country and access to resources and money paid by that system that he's trying to overthrow. The irony of that is just striking. And it's hard to comprehend that the system that you're trying to overthrow has given you so much. And this is not to say that Western democracy is absolutely perfect. It's nowhere near perfect. There are so many things wrong with it. We have corrupt leaders. We have corrupt organizations led by power hungry. I mean, there are so many issues to fix. But the notion that it needs to be brought down is a misunderstood concept, I think, because they don't, you know, people who make these claims have not lived through when this system actually came down. What happens next? You know, you can ask, you know, the young people who rallied, you know, the world cheered when, you know, teenagers and young people got to Tahrir Square and started the Arab Spring. That revolution is just adrenaline pumping, and you want to do that. And this is not an exclusive result of just that revolution. Almost many, majority of revolutions doesn't result in what you think it's going to result in. If you think the Middle East is better off now after the revolution, I think you are not looking at it from a pragmatic, objective point of view. It's actually, in most places, worse off for its people.
The thread that I feel like keeps getting pulled is like the idea that, well, let's say, so burning and looting is necessary. If you run with that claim and you see any footage, or if you've been on the ground and see, you know, a person, a perfectly innocent person who has a small business and their business getting burned down and them trying to put it out and then them getting, you know, beat on because they're trying to put the fire out. The idea there is, well, we can sacrifice this one idiot who no one cares about for the greater good. And I think that's that is absolutely in reverse of what would make a movement flourish. That collectivist calculus that one person could be sacrificed and it's fine, rather than we need to preserve the freedom and rights and safety of all people to the best extent that we can. So I would suppose that is happening in a more sophisticated way. I don't know if that's really the term to use on the left than on the right. And I would imagine that would be why you're shining the spotlight on it.
Kurt says this in the film, groups don't suffer, people suffer.
Mm.
The idea that this perceived group or a certain, I mean, within the current intersectional ideology, groups are more and more smaller, but these sets of groups suffer is a great way of presenting a certain problem. But sometimes, actually in many scenarios, it misses the individual. Now, from a scientific and reason-based point of thinking, you don't necessarily look at one set of, you know, individual, rather you look at a group to make certain decisions. But that's not the way the left is looking at, you know, that particular example. It is a fundamentally different way of looking at things, and this collateral damage is okay. It's funny, just 2 days ago I was at a barbecue and I was speaking to somebody who was going on a bit of a rant, saying, comparing Australia to North Korea because the travel restrictions due to a once in a lifetime pandemic, saying that, you know, her individual freedoms have been trampled on and she can't do what she wants to do. And when I said, how would you feel, you know, if Australia was going through what, say, America went through a few months ago, or what's going through in India, and literally thousands of people are dying, including, you know, your parents. And her response was, it's collateral damage. And that, you know, I can't think about human life in those terms. It's just, there is something, it's almost like Thanos-like thinking, right? You know, it's for the greater good. It's just a misunderstood way of looking at the human condition. Both on the left and the right, people do it, and it's terrible.
What are your fears that if things were to escalate on either, I don't even know if we'll call them sides anymore, but just any radical behavior, political lies, socialized political behavior escalates, what would you think are some of the more tangible results we would see from that?
I mean, you've already lived through a bit of it. The Trump presidency is a great example of what it can lead to. You had an insurrection. You've had a pandemic mishandled in absolutely, utterly catastrophic proportions. Half a million people died because of that. So I don't need hypotheticals to explain what could have gone wrong. And if we don't come back to a relative sort of the middle ground, what can happen is more and more of these ideas, these bad ideas, will be propagated as good ideas, and they will be experimented on among society. And I don't mean to sound like an alarmist, and even if I am, I'd rather be an alarmist at this point.
Incorrect alarmist, yeah.
You're right, rather than just being a passive absorber as Western civilization collapses on itself, is if we let certain ideologies become the norm with the intention, and this is something that I spoke about in my last film as well, especially on the left, it comes from a good intention. It comes from a place wanting to help the marginalized people.
Mm-hmm.
but it actually in the long term hurts not just the marginalized people that they want to help, but overall society. And if we don't challenge these ideas, if we somehow get to a point where our ability to challenge these ideas are muted, we are looking at collapse of Western civilization and the Enlightenment values that has given us these things. It's not a good place. We don't want to get to that point.
So there's an idea that people have, and I guess it would just be an example of reducing dissonance, that as you say, we've lived through some chaos relative to what we experienced in years past, or relative to what we feel in our homes and our own lives. And I think there's a sense that something like Trump being out of office, restrictions loosening from this pandemic will solve these, will ameliorate a lot of the troubles that we see, and things will flatten out. I don't get the sense from your film that you believe that those are the simple solutions to the problems that we face. In fact, if you just said that there's something about the rhetoric and the way that it's propagated that is actually leading to these problems. So what is an example, since you've mentioned that in some ways these ideas that are being propagated, let's say for trying to help marginalized groups, what are some ideas that are okay ideas? And what are some ideas that, I guess what I'm trying to say is, where do those ideas start to veer from compassionate and reasonable to something that is more unreasonable? And how do you track that? And how can you tell?
Okay, so let me take a trip down memory lane to my first film, right? Mm-hmm. There's a very clear example of this. Since 9/11, the Western world fundamentally changed the way it looks at Muslim people and Islam as an ideology. And the far right, the furthest of the right, wanted to pin the world's problems on them, Muslim people. And the furthest of the left was desperately trying to protect that marginalized group by not talking about the ideology, not the people.
Right.
And that led to an utterly chaotic time where the problem didn't go away. You know, it in the 70s, from the Mujahideen to the Taliban to the Al-Qaeda's, and then eventually to Al-Shabaab and ISIS, et cetera, the problem never went away. And then the problem got exported to the West, and bombs were going all across the world, and still people weren't having a reasonable conversation. And that's why I wanted to show this. There is an ideology that needs to be surgically decapitated to a certain degree and say, hey, this ideology, there are some elements of that is inspiring a small group of people within a larger cohort. And we need to look at it, just the ideology, not the people, but the ideas. We did that with Christianity, and we got to a point, you know, we all agree, in even modern day Christians scoff at the Old Testament. You know, we don't take that. It's a New Testament, you know, like that. But you have, again, on the left, whenever, you know, my people, you know, got very worried whenever somebody was talking about, hey, what's the punishment for apostasy?
Right.
People freaked out. You don't ask that question. And why can't we draw Muhammad? What's wrong with it? It's just a, you know, drawing. No, you can't. You know, people were justifying people being murdered for a cartoon. So even today, now we don't report about it, but the idea of Islamist extremism and jihadism, it's not gone away. Just last week, there was an incident, two incidents in Europe, and what's happening in Africa, certain parts of Africa, Indonesia. This problem won't go away just because we stop talking about it. It's just, that's not how problems like this work. And that's a good example of our failure. I think we've gotten better at it, but we've got other problems, much bigger problems, immediate problems now. So we're not talking about it. The other example is, the American race issue. America has made incredible progress from the days of slavery to the modern day. But if you look at American mainstream, I don't mean to caricaturize the mainstream media, but if you look at wherever you look at it, CNN, MSNBC, wherever it is, the race issue, if an alien landed today and looked at American television now, they would assume it is as bad as the days of slavery. There's been no progress. Black people in America are hunted down on the street every day. But it is factually inaccurate. This is not to say there is no race issue in America, right? But again, the way it's presented, it is this catastrophizing of what's actually happening. And that that prevents you from actually looking at how to fix the issue, because you don't have a clear understanding of the issue itself. You know, that's why, again, we spend painstaking hours explaining Islam as an ideology. You know, what is a conservative Muslim or in somebody who believes in this section? Who is an Islamist? Who's a jihadist? Who are, you know, what are the different variations within that ideology? And just like that, the American race issue is quite complex. It's not that simple. But if you listen to people who are the leaders of this conversation, America is a white supremacist nation. Right. Every white person is born a racist, whether they like it or not, and they need to continue to repent every single day for a sin that they can never overcome. It's the new modern day original sin. And you know, black people are just oppressed at every walk of life, which again, you are really painting a picture that is so far from reality. Again, this is not to say there aren't issues. There are issues that needs to be addressed. But when you paint a picture like that, you are really, really presenting a terrible idea that is eventually going to hurt the people you want to help.
I work a lot with families and children. I just wrote a book about it, actually, about addiction and kids growing up. And something I think that parents can get wrong sometimes is that they're being compassionate and nice to their kids. And I think that something about being truly compassionate and truly caring for your kid is not just being nice all of the time, but rendering them competent to deal with this world. And so you can get into this thinking that, you know, each and every day in each interaction, you should be as nice as you possibly can. You do that with the risk of things becoming catastrophic later on in that person's lifespan. Similarly, you're talking about Islam. So we wanted to preserve the most vulnerable of the population of people who are being mischaracterized by not talking at all about some of the most extreme versions of that, those ideas. So I see that as something parallel. I see people taking action rather than sitting still and thinking that that's brave. Although this brave, I don't know how brave it is to march among a crowd of people who, you know, agree with you, knowing fairly well that there's probably not going to be a ton of violence your way if you're able to wrap yourself in the warm blanket of the group. So I think that we get bravery wrong. I say we because I'm on the left and I like to think of it that way. And I think I have my own, I was a major Bernie guy when he was running, and I've become more center. So I say what we're getting wrong is the idea of bravery. We're not seeing it on balance. The idea of compassion, we're not getting a balanced view of compassion, and the idea of critical thinking. I think that we misunderstand what that means. Critical thinking, I think, has come to mean something like studying how to say the right things, how to use the correct rhetoric, how to atone for your sinfulness for me being a white person. And I'm curious about if you've thought about how to even overcome any of these things, because not only do we get these things wrong, the media is media in general, social media, all media is very good at picking up on people's fears and making them saleable and saleable and scalable. So I think we're fighting a lot of demons at once.
I think one of the bright lights that I see is the space that you operate in right now, this podcast, and hopefully my documentary. When things have gotten to a point where they're bad and I feel like they're going to get worse a little bit, but this has also pushed a lot of people to try and understand the problem better. And the way the current social media and mainstream media is structured, you can't really delve into details because, you know, a number of characters short, or the TV time is very short. Like, I mean, right, you don't get long form interviews. And now people are listening to podcasts that make sense to them, that they can comprehend, but goes into more the nuance. And that will eventually bleed through to the mainstream. You know, when you look at the listenership of, say, Joe Rogan, et cetera, it is mainstream. Because that's the ginormous number anyway. So I do see people pushing back on some of these ideas. And I think people like you and I who have the ability to get this information in front of people, we should do more of this. I think that is one part of the solution. And then, in a way, and I use this word, when we do this, when we normalize dissent, to use a term from the far furthest of the left, when we normalize dissent, it actually empowers other people who want to talk about these things.
Yes.
And the other thing is, when you do it in a way that is not necessarily self-serving, and people can see it transparently, you are genuinely trying. Like, you know, I see people who turn provocateurs, who say things, it's self-serving. They know they're going to get a reaction, and they know they're going to use that reaction to either political gain or financial gain, etc. But then there's larger groups of people who can influence the local community, 50 people, 100 people on their social media. They start doing that because they now have the basis, because they listen to this podcast or watch a movie, so they can at least have the basic knowledge base because it's available. So we should make this more available. I'll give you one anecdote, and I tell this story because it was so powerful when it happened and I witnessed it. For Islam and the Future of Tolerance, before that, I did a tour in Australia with Sam Harris and Majid Nawaz, who are basically the two protagonists in the documentary. The last event happened in Sydney, and this was the most intense event I've ever organized, because we actually had credible threats. And just to put it in perspective, normally at an event, we have, you know, at an event with 2,000 people, we have two security guards, that's just standard, you know, and then we have lots of ushers and whatnot. But for this event, the day before the event, the bomb squad came along to the venue with sniffer dogs, did a full run through the venue just to make sure.
Yeah.
And then for 24 hours, the police, both the federal and the local police, basically were around the venue just making sure. And then the day of the event, we had to hire, on the advice of the police, we had to hire 26 security guards. And for the first time and the last time, we had to hire armed security guards. See, in Australia, you don't see, not even, sometimes even police don't really have a loaded weapon. It's very unusual. And we now had a small army of security guards with weapons on top of the police with their weapons. Mm. And police cars stop on either side of the street of the venue. And we had to install metal detectors at this venue, which didn't have metal detectors because it's not normal over here.
You were like the JFK airport.
It was very, people had to take everything they had in their pockets. And we had to send an email to ticket holders saying, don't bring bags. Don't bring bags. So whatever in your pocket, they had to run through the thing. That was unusual. And police and security pat down certain people. So, you know, it was just insanity. We had to get personal bodyguards for both Sam Harris and Majid Nawaz behind the scenes.
Wow.
And at that, right towards the end of that event, Majid made a comment to the audience and he said, he's seen everything that's just happened. You know, the security, the bomb squad, and all that insanity. And he basically thanked the audience for spreading the threat. Now, it wasn't, normally it's just him who needs all of that. Now there's 2,500 people in a place that took the risk on to be there, sort of normalized that, hey, having this conversation is okay. It's not wrong for us to have conversations. So that's, I think I see that as a great story. And for me, the stuff I do know I'm taking a risk in many areas because I have people who don't speak to me anymore. I have venues that, I've lost sponsors who won't speak to me, respond to me anymore because what they think I'm doing is wrong. Or by association, they worry they'll get something. But that's okay because I then have, you know, thousands of people who watch the documentaries or attend the events that sort of makes me feel as, okay, I'm not doing the wrong thing here. I'm trying to do the thing to hopefully everyone can look at these ideas because it's important we get our head around these issues.
Were you ever worried? Did the idea of threats, and not only physical or violent or, you know, assaultive threats, but the threat of losing ground in your own tribe ever discourage you or keep you silent?
For some reason, it never did because I felt like my tribe is bigger. And you know, not to sound self-righteous, I also felt like everything I was doing was bigger than me. I've always looked after myself and I've always moved around and I've always sort of adapted. I knew if something goes wrong, I'll figure out a way, you know, 'cause I always do.
Majid and Sam Harris talked about it. You mentioned this, you alluded to this a little earlier, there's concentric circles of ideology. You know, the most extreme and people who are supportive of the most extreme, even if they aren't, and people who are tolerant of the supporters of the most extreme. Do you see that same sort of concentric formation around ideologies now?
Yeah, I do actually, because we are led to believe there is a far left and a far right.
Yeah.
It is not that simple.
That's exactly you'd be surprised. What I mean, yes.
Yeah. So there's this big gradient. People who believe certain things on this end may not necessarily believe all of it, but also people who are sort of passively supporting certain things, you wouldn't even know. And this was very evident. The example you used, there is this very small minority of jihadists who want to cause actual violence to create a caliphate. But there is a smaller group of people who are a bit more strategic about to get to that caliphate, who are using democracy and modern politics and strategies to get into power, like Muslim Brotherhood, who successfully deployed those strategies and came to power in countries. But then you have this quite a large group of people who don't either directly support violence or overthrowing of governments, but they are sympathetic towards the reasons why they're happening. And this group generally is a lot bigger than people assume. They're the people who may have homophobic ideologies because they're conservative Muslims. And they actually adhere to a certain aspect of that religion. So for them, that's a sin. and they have certain strong views about people who are not of the religion, but they don't act on it, but they are okay while the Islamists go ahead and act on it. And I see this in the political spectrum, which is you're not necessarily supportive of somebody from the furthest of the right talking about Anglo-Saxon ethno-nation or any of that stuff. But they do understand when everyone's calling them a racist, they're born racist, you know, white, they all of a sudden feel like, well, at least somebody should speak about that. I'm just going to stay quiet here. You know, because, hey, you know, I'm not racist, but you're calling me one. You know, maybe those guys have something to, you know, maybe there's something to that. I don't know. It's just that, you know, I'm just asking questions kind of thing. I'm just letting it happen. The same happens on the left, right?
So people are kind of feeling, I hope this gets sorted out.
Yeah.
Because, I don't have the energy to think about this, or I don't want to speak up about it.
Yeah. That's why we need to, whenever we get the chance, we just speak up about it. And then say, hey, hold on. This, what you're passively observing, is morally and ethically wrong. And we're standing on the shoulders of giants. We have enough of human history to say, here's why this is wrong. You know, and we cannot and we should not be passive observers as our society completely gets altered in a way that is not positive, because we should always change. We should strive to be better. There is a finite balance between insane progressive ideas and the absolute carbon ceramic breaks of the conservatives who doesn't want to change anything. There is a happy medium there. And that's what we should strive for.
Now, Kurt, in the movie, do you have time for a few more questions, by the way? I had us at an hour.
I have a bit more time.
Okay. Kurt in the movie was very direct, and I suppose that's because it's a scripted film. In our conversation, he and I spoke a few days ago. I noticed that he was trying to capture holistically the kind of a person who might be making each kind of an argument. You were just describing this like complete spectrum of people and the way they think. And every time I tried to ask him about an idea, I mean, it's like he got himself into the weeds. It was just complete ontology and which he copped to. And I noticed what he was doing was that he wasn't letting me get away with strawmanning or simplifying any idea or human any human being as limited to just one idea. That's just a bad one.
So there's an interesting dynamic between Kurt and I. We actually disagree on a number of things, even some stuff on the film. But that actually made me even more wanting to make this film with him, because his approach is this honest approach, a good faith attempt at tackling certain subject matter. It doesn't really matter we disagree. It is what is needed. You know, this idea of we cannot have conversations with the people that we disagree with or the political other is just a terrible, terrible norm that's been propagated. It should not be the case. Yes, I strongly, strongly disagree with a whole bunch of ideas from a lot of people from the furthest of the right, but that doesn't, it's not going to stop me from having a conversation with them. That's just a misguided form of understanding human connection. Now with Kurt, I sometimes think he gets in the way of himself. He thinks so deeply and so much, and sometimes it's not as complicated as you think it is. It is a bit simple, but that's why I love making this film. And you can you may see, if you watch the movie, there is a little push and pull. And if you can be bothered, watch the director's cut. It's on betterleftunsaidfilm.com.
I have to watch the director's cut now. Yeah. Sorry, you say the link again. I'll put it in the show notes.
betterleftunsaidfilm.com. It's only exclusively available on the website. Is that really shows. So the public version, which I was heavily involved in editing that, is about half an hour short. And even then, about 20%, I would have changed. But, you know, we agreed to disagree and release it. But then the director's cut, Kurt got his way. So you can see what I mean. When you watch it, you understand. But it's okay. And it is how it should be. Because we came to an agreement that worked for both parties. And yeah.
When it comes to, well, first of all, that's great. That's like a true dialectic, you know, coming to fruition in a synthesis. So when you talk about people who should speak up, I mean, you already said people with a platform. I feel that way too. There's a podcast called The Social Exchange. It was supposed to be, one of my first guests was Charles Murray, for instance.
Wow.
And it was, people sometimes don't believe me because it was after Sam Harris's podcast with him. But I live in Vermont near Middlebury College. So I got interested in him right around that time when Sam spoke with him. And I reached out to him because I'm so nearby. And I thought that the whole thing was fascinating because I agreed with the Middlebury students on the premise that he was wrong and maybe that he was racist. I, of course, didn't agree with the way that they protested. I completely disagree with that. I'm a free speech absolutist. So when I spoke with him, it was supposed to be, look, I don't agree with anything you say, but let me give you a platform like you never got. And what it came to be was that I read his book and I didn't disagree with him as fervently as I believe that I did. So that's what this show became about, was talking about very difficult topics that maybe people don't feel like they need to bother to think about. And as the political climate has sort of escalated, I felt that I either need to tackle these topics that you're talking about, which scares me, or just stop podcasting. I mean, one or the other. I don't think I could do, but ignore and continue to podcast. It's just not what I want to do. So when it comes to speaking up and who should speak up, can you talk about, I'll just assume that you've thought about this. What are some reasons why people's fears are true about when it comes to speaking up, speaking your mind, speaking against bad ideas? And to what extent do you think people are sort of catastrophizing the possibility of what would happen if only they spoke up?
I think just, one side of the argument says cancel culture is not real. The other side says it is everywhere. They're both using what's happening to their own advantage. There is definitely, the evidence is absolutely and utterly overwhelming that people have lost their livelihoods, jobs, because of something they've said. People have been deplatformed because of an old idea or a perception of an idea they may have had, or associations. I believe there's a website that somebody is documenting all these stories